Layer 751, Wartime Conferences. A text panel on the wall to your right reads, FDR held the key position in a wartime coalition of 26 countries he called the United Nations. He, Joseph Stalin, and Winston Churchill comprised the big three at the heart of this coalition. But as the war progressed, FDR increasingly acted as the group's ultimate broker and decision-maker. During the war, Roosevelt attended 12 major diplomatic conferences in North America, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. The Allied strategies that won World War II were forged at these meetings. The most important conferences were the final two, held at Tehran and Yalta. There, the big three discussed war issues, but they also tangled over the shape of the post-war world. Along the wall, about 2 feet down to your left, another panel, on your right, tells of FDR's wartime travels. FDR traveled extensively during the war. Not content to monitor industrial and military progress from Washington, he made extensive inspection trips to factories, testing grounds, and bases. Roosevelt also undertook overseas trips to attend conferences and confer with military leaders. Some involved weeks of grueling travel by sea, land, and air. FDR preferred journeying overseas by Navy ship. These were outfitted with elevators and railings to accommodate his disability. In 1943, he became the first president to fly when he traveled to the Casablanca Conference aboard a commercial aircraft. Military concerns later led to the construction of the first presidential aircraft, a Douglas VC-54C, nicknamed the Sacred Cow. FDR used it to fly to the Yalta Conference. The plane's unpressurized cabin made long-distance travel uncomfortable, but it included features that enhanced FDR's mobility, including an elevator that lifted him in his wheelchair directly into the aircraft. Roosevelt's favorite way to travel was aboard Navy ships. Continuing along the wall another 3 feet brings us to a panel on your right describing the first of FDR's wartime conferences, which reads, Tehran, the key issues. The key issue at the Tehran conference was the Second Front, but other important subjects also dominated discussion. Though the war was far from won, the shape of the post-war world was on the minds of the big three. FDR tried to establish a personal rapport with Stalin, hoping to build a foundation for post-war cooperation. Talks included the future of Germany and a United Nations organization. Stalin also confirmed his commitment to declare war against Japan once Hitler was defeated. But fears of a resurgent post-war Germany led Stalin to demand territorial adjustments in Eastern Europe to create a large buffer zone between Germany and the Soviet Union. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed to cede Eastern Poland to the Soviets after the war, but they postponed discussion of other territorial adjustments. From a position facing this panel, the wall makes a jog to the left. Turn to your left and follow along this wall about 2 feet to a large text panel on your right, which reads, The Tehran Conference, the Big Three, meet. We have concerted our plans for the destruction of the German forces. We have reached complete agreement as to the scope and timing of the operations to be undertaken from the east, west, and south. Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, Joseph Stalin, Tehran Declaration, December 1, 1943. In November 1943, FDR journeyed to the Middle East to attend his first wartime conference with Joseph Stalin. The big three, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Winston Churchill, gathered at Tehran, Iran. The decisions they made there shaped both the war and the peace that followed. The issue of a second front commanded the greatest attention. Impatient with Anglo-American postponements, Stalin demanded a firm commitment to a date for the invasion of Northwest Europe. Churchill favored further delay, arguing instead for new military initiatives in Italy and the Balkans. But FDR sided with Stalin, and the three leaders agreed to a spring 1944 invasion. Stalin then pressed his allies to quickly name the invasion's commander. Shortly after the conference, FDR selected General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Walk about another 3 feet to your left, and on your right is a plexiglass case displaying a draft telegram from FDR to Churchill. It discusses the timing for the announcement of General Dwight D. Eisenhower as the commander for the invasion of Normandy, and a sketch he made during the Tehran conference of his early concept for a United Nations structure. About 6 feet further down to your left is a panel on your right that introduces the second of FDR's wartime conferences entitled Yalta, the Key Issues. At Yalta, FDR won Stalin's assurances to enter the war against Japan and join the United Nations organization. But Europe's future proved a thornier issue. Faced with the reality of large Soviet armies in Eastern Europe and unable to contemplate going to war with Russia, FDR and Churchill quietly acquiesced to Stalin's demand for a sphere of influence there. They managed to secure Soviet acceptance of the Declaration of Liberated Europe and an agreement on Poland, calling for a government of national unity that would hold free and unfettered elections. But Stalin didn't honor the agreement. After the war, critics charged Roosevelt gave away Eastern Europe. Today, Yalta occupies an ambiguous place in historical memory. Those who met there witnessed the cooperation of wartime allies and the rising wariness of future rivals. Just about 2 feet further along is another panel which reads, "The Yalta Conference, Winning the War, Debating the Peace." I didn't say the result was good. I said it was the best I could do. Franklin Roosevelt to diplomat Adolf Berl. In the winter of 1945, Roosevelt met with Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin for the last time. The setting was the Ukrainian town of Yalta. The Big Three gathered to chart a course for final victory in World War II. But during the Yalta Conference, they also struggled to create the basis for post-war cooperation. FDR received Stalin's firm commitment to enter the increasingly bloody war against Japan 3 months after Germany's defeat. With American casualties rising in the Pacific War and the atomic bomb yet untested, this was a significant achievement for the president. The Big Three also formally agreed to another of FDR's priorities, the establishment of the United Nations organization. But there were serious disagreements about the future of Germany and the fate of areas occupied by Soviet armies, especially Poland. On the wall is a large-scale photograph of FDR, Stalin, and Churchill seated with military and civilian staff around a large, round conference table. Below this panel is an interactive exhibit on an angled ledge stand that protrudes from the wall about 12 inches. It is entitled, "Confront the Issue, FDR at Yalta." Text explains, "After the war, the Yalta Conference became the subject of sharp controversy and debate. As the Cold War descended over Europe, critics argued FDR gave away Eastern Europe at the conference. Over the ensuing decades, historians have continued to explore and debate FDR's actions at Yalta. A more balanced view of the conference has emerged over time." Touch the screen to explore the historical debate and key documents from the FDR Library collections. You may listen to the interactive material or press the right arrow key on your audio tour player to exit this layer of recorded information and continue with the rest of the tour. FDR at Yalta. After the war, the Yalta Conference became the subject of sharp controversy and debate. As the Cold War descended over Europe, critics argued FDR gave away Eastern Europe at the conference. Demagogues like Senator Joseph McCarthy went further, charging the agreements the president made at Yalta were treasonous. Others speculated that Roosevelt's ill health impaired his judgment at the conference. Over the ensuing decades, historians have continued to explore and debate FDR's actions at Yalta. Scholars have refuted the most reckless charges made by Roosevelt's critics, including the argument that he was mentally impaired at the conference. By early 1945, FDR was ill and incapable of working effectively for long hours. But his condition did not affect how he conducted diplomacy at Yalta. A more balanced view of the conference has emerged over time. The president's defenders point out that it was the Soviet Union, not the West, which violated the agreements reached at Yalta. They also argue that critics overlook the pressing need to preserve the fragile Allied coalition in the midst of the war. The American military's strong desire to ensure Soviet participation in the planned invasion of Japan, which was expected to be very costly, and the dominant position of the Red Army on the ground in Eastern Europe in early 1945. These factors placed real limits on FDR and Churchill. In the end, they compromised with the Soviets, maintained the Allied coalition, and struggled to establish a framework for post-war cooperation. The following screens contain reproductions of selected documents from the FDR Library and excerpts of the historical debate that relate to FDR and the Yalta Conference. Document 1, title, FDR's Cable to Winston Churchill Regarding a Conference Meeting Place, date December 23, 1944. Caption, following the successful Normandy landings in June 1944, President Roosevelt pressed Stalin for another face-to-face meeting. But with Soviet armies now retaking vast Eastern European territories from the Nazis, Stalin was in no hurry to meet with his allies. Pleading health concerns and fearful of leaving the security of Soviet territory, Stalin rejected meeting locations in the Mediterranean that were more convenient for FDR and Churchill. In this December cable, the president agreed to meet in the Soviet Union. The location was a small town on the Crimean Peninsula, a nearly 14,000-mile round trip for the president by ship, airplane, and automobile. The conference was codenamed Argonaut to reflect the journey's epic nature. Citation, Maproom Papers, Argonaut 1, Section 1, Box 21. Document 2, title, State Department Briefing Memorandum for the President, date January 18, 1945. Caption, the issues to be resolved at Yalta were many. In particular, FDR wanted to guarantee the Soviet Union's entry into the war against Japan and its participation in the post-war United Nations organization. But other issues also loomed as the American delegation prepared to depart for the conference. Secretary of State Edward Stettinius Jr. submitted to the president a series of briefing papers with this cover memorandum listing additional complex diplomatic decisions to be made by the Big Three. These decisions would shape the post-war world for decades to come. Citation, President's Secretary's Files, Subject Files, Crimea Conference, Box 129. Document 3, title, Memorandum of Conversation of FDR and Stalin's First Meeting at Yalta, date February 4, 1945. Caption, in recognition of FDR's physical limitations and his status as a head of state, all of the sessions of the Big Three leaders took place at the Tsarist-era palace that served as Roosevelt's headquarters at Yalta. Just before the opening session, Stalin paid his respects to the president at Levadia Palace, their first face-to-face meeting since the Tehran Conference in December 1943. Roosevelt used this meeting to try to gain Stalin's personal trust for the talks ahead. In this memorandum of their conversation, FDR expresses his anger at German barbarism, belittles Free French leader Charles de Gaulle, and previews the discussions that would take place about a British proposal for a French zone of occupation in a defeated Germany. Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 4, title, FDR's Letter to Stalin Regarding Poland. Date, February 6, 1945. Caption, Poland was the agenda topic at a tense conference session on February 6, 1945. Every possible geopolitical problem was wrapped up in the subject of Poland, the relationship between large and small nations, the hope for a world peace organization versus the reality of great power spheres of influence, and the legitimacy of wartime territorial acquisitions. The Big Three came to Yalta recognizing two different Polish governments. The British and Americans recognized a democratic government in exile based in London. Stalin recognized the so-called Lublin Poles installed by the Soviets as the provisional Polish government. Following their contentious February 6th meeting, FDR personally wrote to Stalin, searching for a resolution that could satisfy both sides in the creation of a new, democratically elected Polish government. Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 5, title, Soviet Proposals in Response to FDR's February 6th Letter on Poland. Date, February 7, 1945. Caption, for domestic political reasons, FDR and Churchill sought to include at least some representation by the London Poles in a new Polish government. Fearful of another future German invasion of the Soviet Union, Stalin insisted on a Polish government loyal to the Soviets. The reality of Soviet Red Army troops now occupying Poland weakened Roosevelt and Churchill's bargaining position. As part of the negotiations, Stalin claimed large amounts of eastern Poland as Soviet territory, a claim agreed to previously by the Big Three at Tehran. This moved the Soviet border some 200 miles closer to Germany. In exchange, Poland was expanded north and westward into Germany, a move that would weaken a future German state and make any Polish government more reliant on the Soviet Union for protection. Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 6, title, Declaration on Poland. Date, February 10, 1945. Caption, having unsuccessfully lobbied Stalin for the creation of a democratically elected Polish government based on the London government in exile, Roosevelt and Churchill still needed a solution that would be politically acceptable back home. For Churchill, the issue of Poland was a matter of British honor. Britain had entered the war in 1939 in defense of Poland. For Roosevelt, the legitimacy of a post-war United Nations organization would be called into question without a satisfactory resolution of the Polish government problem. Ultimately, the Big Three agreed to this Declaration on Poland that papered over their disagreements. Stalin agreed only that the existing Polish government, his Lublin government, would be reorganized on existing lines and that free and unfettered elections would be held as soon as possible, a promise he never kept. Churchill later said that the agreement on Poland was the best that he could get, and when Roosevelt was challenged by an aide on the agreement's elasticity, FDR responded, "It's the best I can do for Poland at this time." Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 7, title, FDR's Letter to Stalin on United Nations Voting Procedures. Date, February 10, 1945. Caption, one of Franklin Roosevelt's major goals for the Yalta Conference was to secure the Soviet Union's participation in the post-war United Nations organization. The broad outline of the United Nations had been discussed by the Big Three at Tehran in 1943, And in 1944, an international conference established more specific details on how the body would be organized, including a one-nation, one-vote procedure in the General Assembly. To Stalin, however, the General Assembly seemed packed with British dominions and subservient Latin American nations that could conspire with Britain and the United States against Soviet interests. He insisted that the Soviet Union be given additional votes in the General Assembly. In this letter, FDR agreed to this request, but fearing a political backlash back home, he asks that the United States also be allowed additional votes, if needed, to ensure acceptance by Congress. Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 8. Title, Stalin's Reply to FDR's Letter on United Nations Voting Procedures. Date, February 11, 1945. Caption, the United Nations organization mattered little to Stalin. He believed that world security ultimately depended on deals made between the world's great powers. But given how important the UN was to the Americans, he extracted two additional General Assembly votes for the Soviet Union in exchange for Soviet participation. He also agreed to support Roosevelt's proposal for additional United States votes. For Roosevelt, the agreement for Soviet participation in the United Nations, even with the troublesome additional votes, was a major victory. The president's longtime vision of establishing a post-war world organization to prevent another world war was finally realized. The Big Three agreed that the founding conference of the United Nations would take place in San Francisco on April 25, 1945. FDR planned to attend. Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 9, title, Agreement on Soviet Entry into the War Against Japan. Date, February 11, 1945. Caption, a key objective for FDR at the Yalta Conference was to secure the Soviet Union's entry into the war against Japan. The war in Europe was drawing to an end, but Roosevelt did not know whether the as-yet untested atomic bomb would be ready in time to be used against Japan. U.S. planners feared large American casualties in an invasion of the Japanese home islands. Roosevelt wanted Soviet troops to tie down the Japanese in Manchuria and safeguard American air bases in China. In return, Stalin wanted a pro-Soviet Outer Mongolia and guaranteed access to Chinese ports and railroads critical to the Soviet supply line. He also demanded a resolution to islands whose ownership was contested between Japan and the Soviet Union. Most controversially, the Kuril Islands chain, which had never been fully owned by Russia and was ethnically Japanese, was handed over outright to the Soviet Union. This agreement, signed by Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin on February 11, 1945, was kept secret from the Chinese government until June and not released publicly until early 1946. Despite the territorial concessions made to Stalin, Roosevelt and his military advisors believed that they had saved 2 million Americans with the agreement. Citation, Maproom Papers, Crimean Conference, Box 29. Document 10, title, excerpt from a speech by Adolf A. Burl, Jr. Date, May 26, 1965. Caption, once the Big Three had reached substantial agreement on all the major issues, FDR pushed for a quick conclusion to the Yalta Conference. After the various final documents were signed on February 11th, Roosevelt and his delegation quickly departed. FDR left feeling confident that he had achieved his two major objectives, Soviet participation in the United Nations and Soviet entry into the war against Japan. But the agreements that had to be made in order to secure these objectives troubled him privately. When he arrived back at the White House on February 28th, one of those there to greet him was longtime advisor and Assistant Secretary of State Adolf A. Burl, Jr. Years later, Burl recalled his conversation with Roosevelt that day about the conference agreements. "Adolf, I didn't say the result was good," said FDR. "I said it was the best I could do." Citation, Adolf A. Burl, Jr., Papers, Speeches, January to May, 1965, Box 155. Document 11. Title, White House Summary of Public Reaction to the Yalta-Crimean Conference. Date, February 17th to 18th, 1945. Caption, despite FDR's private misgivings, the publicly released results of the Yalta Conference mostly received strong support from the American people, the Congress, and the press, at least initially. For a time, a spirit of Yalta seemed to pervade public opinion in the United States and abroad, as shown in this news summary prepared by the White House. But not all of the agreements reached at Yalta were known by the public at the time, including the agreement to give the Soviet Union more United Nations votes and the territorial gains promised to Stalin in exchange for Soviet entry into the war against Japan. The failure to hold truly free elections in Poland also soured public opinion toward the Yalta agreements and vexed Roosevelt's final days. He died of a cerebral hemorrhage on April 12, 1945, just 2 weeks before the opening conference of the United Nations. Citation, Official File 4675, World War II, Crimean Conference, Box 3. Yalta Book Quotes, John T. Flynn, The Roosevelt Myth, The Devon Adair Company, 1956, pages 387 to 389 and 394. It is the simple truth to say that Stalin had out-generaled Roosevelt at every point. Or perhaps it would be nearer the truth to say that Roosevelt had out-generaled himself. It is difficult to believe that a responsible statesman, unattended by his advisors and handicapped by a grave physical disability, could go to so momentous a meeting with two such astute colleagues as Stalin and Churchill without preparation. The formal proposal to hand over eastern Poland, east of the Curzon line, was made by Roosevelt himself. As to western Poland, Stalin already had a government there named by him and composed of communists representing no one but Stalin himself. To compensate Poland for that half wrung from her by Russia, it was agreed to give Poland a part of East Prussia, a totally German land. The conference also decided upon the partition of Germany into three zones, each to be occupied provisionally by the Russian, British, and American armies, and to be separately administered. A reparations commission was set up to study the amounts. Russia wanted the amount to be $20 billion, of which she would take half. It was agreed that labor might be taken as a possible source of reparations. This was just a diplomatic way of authorizing the seizure of human beings to work as slaves after the war ended, and is the basis of that dreadful crime perpetrated after hostilities ceased, to which the President of the United States agreed. Stalin had merely to sit tight to make known his wishes, and Roosevelt laid them in his lap with eager compliance in the notion that he could thus soften Stalin. It is all the more incredible when we remember that the things he was laying in Stalin's lap were the existence of little nations and the rights of little peoples we had sworn to defend. S. M. Plokey, Yalta, The Price of Peace, Viking, 2010, pages 399 to 400 and page 402. Throughout the conference, FDR demonstrated his trademark ability to make alliances, strike deals, and maneuver in order to achieve his main goals. Cold War-era critics and proponents of the Yalta agreements raised a series of questions that continue to influence today's perception of the end of the Second World War. The end of the Cold War and the opening of the Soviet archives allow one to revisit the old debates. One can now approach these questions with a much better appreciation of what Stalin and his entourage knew about their allies from the vast Soviet intelligence network they maintained in the West, what they thought about their partners, what their geopolitical goals were, how they assessed the result of the negotiations, and whether they intended to honor their obligations. There was no instance at Yalta when he yielded on an important issue spontaneously, in clear violation of his earlier position or without consulting his advisors. And there was a remarkable consistency between Roosevelt's positions at Yalta and in Tehran. He was clearly tired and pressed for the conference's early conclusion, but he did not leave Yalta before his main objectives had been achieved. With the passage of time, Yalta became much more important than its participants intended it to be, both as political reality and as historical mythology. In their minds, the conference was in fact only a step on the long road to peace, which is almost always an arduous work in progress. Thomas A. Bailey, A Diplomatic History of the American People, Prentice Hall, 1980. Pages 764 and 766. As was so often the case in World War II, over-concentration on short-run military victory resulted in a long-run moral defeat. The published announcement at Yalta seemed to herald a new day for Poland and the other liberated nations of Central Europe, then partially or wholly occupied by Soviet troops. The Big Three solemnly agreed to facilitate free elections in all of these countries in harmony with the Atlantic Charter. Stalin's subsequent breaking of his free election pledge proved to be one of the great eye-openers of the post-war era. Roosevelt was accused of having naively reposed faith in the word of a dictator who was notoriously untrustworthy, and of thus having sacrificed Poland to Soviet imperialism. The apologist for the president replied that Stalin, with a powerful Red Army at his back, was in a position to work his will anyhow. His cooperation in building a better tomorrow was urgently needed, and Roosevelt, with much public support, believed that more was to be gained by trust than distrust. At all events, a pledge was written into the Crimean Charter which, when flagrantly violated by Stalin, strengthened the moral cause of the Western democracies by clearly highlighting Soviet duplicity. Even so, Yalta became a kind of dirty word in American thinking. The stain of secret diplomacy and under-the-table deals would not wash off. The whole unsavory episode also lent color to the charge that Roosevelt had treacherously permitted communists to infiltrate the State Department and betray the best interests of the United States. The path was further paved for Senator McCarthy and the anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s. Robert Dallek, Franklin D. Roosevelt and American Foreign Policy, 1932 to 1945, Oxford University Press, 1979, pages 419 and 421. On all the central issues, the United Nations, Germany, Poland, Eastern Europe, and the Far East, Roosevelt largely followed through on earlier plans and gained most of what he wished. Much has been made of the idea that Roosevelt was a dying man at Yalta who lacked the physical strength and mental alertness to deal effectively with Stalin. Without question, his physical condition had greatly declined by the time of the conference. At the same time, however, Roosevelt impressed most observers with the recuperative powers. More important, the men closest to him at Yalta thought the president performed effectively. The world body, the division of Germany, the pronouncement on Poland, and the declaration on liberated Europe promised to encourage American involvement abroad and possible long-term accommodation with the USSR. Similarly, the Far East Agreement promised to save American lives and hold China together to play a part in helping the United States preserve post-war peace. In private, Roosevelt was less confident of the results. Adolf Berle, who was very fearful of Russian intentions, saw him just after he returned from Yalta. Roosevelt threw his arms up and said, "Adolf, I didn't say the result was good. I said it was the best I could do." Since he had no intention of confronting Soviet power in East Central Europe, even if he had the troops, Roosevelt's comments to Burl partly sound like the answer he planned to give anti-Soviet critics if the Yalta settlement collapsed. Nevertheless, the conversation is revealing of FDR's uncertainty about the ultimate result of the Yalta talks. Wilson D. Miscampbell, From Roosevelt to Truman, Potsdam, Hiroshima, and the Cold War. Cambridge University Press, 2007, pages 61 and 80. The time has come finally to move beyond the Rooseveltian spell and to acknowledge honestly the limitations of FDR's efforts in preparing for the post-war world. The Yalta Conference holds a notorious reputation for those who associate it with the West's betrayal or sellout of Eastern Europe. But Yalta should not be viewed as a single moment of surrender or betrayal that produced the indefensible partition of Europe. It was but another way station on the course that FDR had long charted, where he might apply his strategy of building personal relations in the interests of drawing the Soviets in to his plans for a new post-war world order. When he joined Stalin and Churchill in the former summer palace of the Tsars in the Crimean resort city, the die was largely cast. Having invested so much of himself in his effort to woo Stalin, he seemed incapable of contemplating second thoughts or reconsiderations. To the end, he remained trapped by the same hopes and, sadly, it must be said, illusions regarding the possibility for genuine cooperation with Stalin that had guided his actions from 1941 onward. In response to criticism, Roosevelt's defenders asked bluntly for a better alternative that would have served American interests in the global war still being fought. In this regard, nothing can be definitively proved, but it seems clear that Roosevelt should have pursued a much more measured embrace of Stalin at the outset and to have allowed advisors genuinely knowledgeable about the Soviet Union to guide his outlook as to the possibilities of long-term cooperation with him. The effort should have been less to win Stalin's trust and more to win his respect. David Reynolds, Summits, Six Meetings That Shaped the 20th Century, Basic Books, 2007, pages 158 through 161. Each of the big three left with the belief that the wartime alliance would continue after the war. That, indeed, had been their major goal for the conference. Where, then, should be the verdict today on Yalta? These were multifaceted negotiations from which each party came away with something. Roosevelt secured his priorities, agreement on the UN, and a Soviet pledge to enter the war against Japan. Churchill managed to avoid firm commitments about Poland's western border, German dismemberment and reparations, the latter to Stalin's undisguised irritation. The British also secured a larger role for France in post-war Europe than either of their partners wanted. Stalin, for his part, gained acceptance of his main territorial goals in Asia and agreements that seemed to recognize his predominance in Poland. Building on Tehran in 1943, they hoped to turn summitry into a process. Yalta was not the moment when the big powers crudely divided Europe. Churchill and FDR were still resisting a stark, separate spheres deal of the sort advocated by George Kennan. Nor was Yalta a sellout of Eastern Europe to the Soviets, as claimed by the Republican right. It was already clear that the Soviet Union would be the predominant influence in Eastern Europe. The aftermath of Yalta did play a significant part in the breakdown of the Grand Alliance, engendering a sense of betrayal on both sides. And the interpretations about why that happened shaped the history of summitry. The Soviets harked back to a golden age of cooperation with Roosevelt that was abandoned by his successors. And in America, the political sensitivity of the Yalta myths haunted policymakers for decades, deterring them from a parley at the summit to thaw the Cold War. Frank Castiglione, Roosevelt's Lost Alliances, How Personal Politics Helped Start the Cold War. Princeton University Press, 2012, pages 242 to 243 and page 248. The 8-day conference entailed tough, exhausting diplomacy among powerful nations. Such serious efforts to hammer out compromises would be largely abandoned in the Cold War. The Soviets bargained from a strong position. While the Red Army battled 45 miles from Berlin, Allied forces remained on the far side of the Rhine, 250 miles away. With the atom bomb still untested, and the United States likely facing heavy casualties in the projected invasion of Japan, the Americans needed the Red Army to tie down Japanese troops in Manchuria and China. The Soviets occupied most of Poland, giving them the upper hand in the most contentious issue during the conference. The Americans and British also held cards, however. By repeatedly praising Lend-Lease, Stalin signaled his desire for post-war credits and equipment. While leaning toward Roosevelt, the dictator also valued the understandings reached with Churchill in Moscow the previous October. Indeed, on the first day of Yalta, he met with the prime minister before seeing the president. He understood that opposition from Washington and London could magnify his problems in securing a Poland strong enough to guard the gate and friendly enough to wish to do so. Above all, the Kremlin chief wanted the Big Three to contain post-war Germany, thereby forestalling another terrible invasion. After a week of hard bargaining, each side emerged satisfied, indeed aglow. Facing the interactive display, a plexiglass case on the wall about 3 feet to the left displays a telegram from Stalin to FDR saying his doctors recommend he not travel outside the Soviet Union, and an agreement which all three leaders signed on the last day of the conference regarding the Soviet Union's entry into the war against Japan. Continue to walk along the wall another 6 feet. On your right is a panel about 4 feet tall and 2 feet wide, with two black handsets hanging at the bottom. In the top third of the panel is a video screen that shows film of FDR's speech to Congress immediately upon returning home from Yalta, which you can listen to. The panel text reads, Yalta Speech to Congress. I hope that you will pardon me for this unusual posture of sitting down, but I know that you will realize that it makes it a lot easier for me not to have to carry about 10 pounds of steel around on the bottom of my legs. Franklin Roosevelt addressed to Congress on the Yalta Conference, March 1, 1945. After the Yalta Conference, FDR made a grueling 7,000-mile journey home by plane and ship. While at sea, his longtime aide and friend, Edwin Pa Watson, died of a stroke. Watson's death cast a pall over the returning presidential party. By the time he returned to Washington, the president was exhausted, but he was determined to report quickly to the nation about the conference. On March 1st, he addressed a joint session of Congress at the Capitol. His audience was struck by FDR's gaunt appearance. Even more striking was that he delivered the speech while seated. FDR confronted the issue directly in the first line of his address, publicly acknowledging his disability for the first and only time in his presidential career. From a position facing this panel, turn around 180 degrees and walk about 8 feet before turning to your right. You will now be automatically redirected back to wherever you left off in the base message.